Hi, it's Diane. So great to be back with you. On my mind this week, volatility in Washington and on Wall Street. It's often said the stock market is not the real economy, but for many, this week's historic sell-off begged the question, just how healthy is the country's economic outlook? And how are Trump's policies affecting Wall Street and Main Street? I spoke with Jim Tankersley, economics and tax reporter for The New York Times.
What the market may be saying here is, in fact, we think that the economy is strong, but for reasons of that strength, we're worried that stocks are overpriced.
Then I sat down with commentator Julie Kohler to talk about how white women vote and why that might be changing.
We have to really look at how much of this is driven by outrage to President Trump versus how much is a really deeper political realignment that's taking place.
But first, I want to give you my personal thoughts on a word that's been in the news of late, treason. Along with many of you, I watched President Trump's State of the Union address last week all the way through to the end. I watched as Republican lawmakers rose and applauded many times. I haven't heard the actual count. I watched as lawmakers on the Democratic side chose to sit through the many standing ovations. Then I heard the president characterize the behavior of those who did not applaud his remarks as, quote, un-American and, quote, treasonous. So I went to the Oxford Dictionary to check. Here's what it says. Treason, the crime of betraying one's country, especially by attempting to kill the sovereign or overthrow the government. Since he used the word, I'd be interested in hearing the president's definition of treasonous. If he's going to label as treasonous failing to clap or cheer or stand while he delivers a State of the Union address, what else might he apply that poisonous word to? Super Bowl winners who decline an invitation to the White House? Generals who believe a military parade in Washington is a bad idea? Those who write or speak out in disagreement with him? Newspaper editors or television news reporters or anchors who ask questions he doesn't want to answer? How far might his definition of treason actually go? I thank God I still live in a country where the privilege of disagreement is the greatest freedom we have, where I can speak my mind and offer my views or choose to sit or stand without fear of being arrested. On the other hand, perhaps President Trump may even decide that this very commentary is treasonous. And then, who knows? I'd be interested to hear your thoughts on the president's use of the word treasonous. Now, here's New York Times reporter Jim Tankersley. Hi, Jim. It's good to have you with us.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me.
First, let's talk about what the stock market actually did this week and where it is as of our conversation on Thursday.
Well, the stock market has been on a bit of a wild ride this week, up and down and down and up. And it's right now down again by several hundred points from where it closed the day before. This has been something traders have not been used to seeing for a while. The market's mostly been going up for the last year, and yet now we've had a sort of a prolonged correction, at least prolonged in terms of a few days.
So we all know markets go up and down, and investors know markets go up and down, and the long-term investors say, well, we just ride through it. But what's going on here? Why is this happening?
It's a really good question, and we can't always say with precision what exactly investors are thinking in the market, but I think we have pretty good data points on this one. I think that this starts with some data that we got late last week on the U.S. job market in January. It showed a faster than expected increase in wages for workers. And I think investors are starting to worry about what that sort of data might mean for the Federal Reserve and for growth. Basically, the argument is that if wages are growing fast, that could mean that faster inflation is finally here after years of waiting for it, which could mean that the Fed's going to raise rates faster than we thought. And when the Fed raises interest rates, that tends to slow growth. And so this could be traders following that little series of event possibilities all the way through and deciding that now might be a better time to do some selling than buying, given that possibility.
Jim, does that always happen? Does history bear out that notion?
History definitely bears out the notion that when inflation rises, the Fed raises interest rates. The question of how fast it will raise them and whether, in fact, inflation is truly going to rise is a bit trickier. We've seen some worries about inflation before over the last few years that didn't end up coming true. There maybe is more reason to think they will come true this time, but there is some caution, I would say. I mean, it's not an ironclad for sure that we're suddenly going to see faster inflation, higher rates, and slower growth. And that's maybe why the sell-off hasn't been catastrophic and just relatively small.
So when markets go nuts, as they seem to be doing right now, you hear economists saying, oh, don't worry, the market is not the real economy. What does that mean?
Well, I mean, it's true. What it means is that stocks don't always react to things in a way that suggests the health of the economy is exactly the same as the health of stock prices. Now, it can be true that a big stock market crash can push you into recession or can lead to a recession. But it also is true that stocks go up and down even during strong times. And in particular, what we're seeing here is a bit of a paradox, that the market is actually saying maybe the economy is stronger than we thought, particularly from the vantage point of workers who really could use some rapid wage growth for a while. We have not seen great wage growth in the wake of the Great Recession. And so what the market may be saying here is, in fact, we think that the economy is strong, but for reasons of that strength, we're worried that stocks are overpriced.
You know what? Isn't it possible that this is simply a correction? The market has been strong. It's gone straight up for, I don't know, the past how many months. It's just kept going up and up and up. And now on the news that workers may get more money, the stock market takes a dive. Somehow it doesn't compute in my mind.
Well, I think it's really, really possible that this is just a modest correction. I mean, you're totally right. The last year, really 2 years of the market have been strong. And really, we've seen sustained market growth throughout the recovery. But starting in sort of early 2016 and then all the way through 2016 and 2017, we've and an accelerating amount at the end of 2017, we've seen the market going up. And that is not entirely supported by the fundamentals of profits and how much companies are earning. And so it may be that traders have finally used this data as an excuse to say, okay, maybe stocks really are overpriced. We're going to take some profits on those, sell them, let them get back toward what may be a more reasonable price given the fundamentals of the economy and of business profits. And then, you know, that's just a small correction, like you're saying, and then it starts moving upward again.
Interesting. But in the meantime, you've got Republicans pouring money into stimulus. So how is that likely to affect Wall Street and the economy in general?
That's a great question, because I think we're in a very interesting experiment right now with fiscal policy. Usually what happens is you spend more money and you cut taxes when the economy is struggling in an attempt to juice growth. What's happened now is that there is been a big tax cut that was passed for reasons that weren't really about trying to do more growth in the short term, but included some real measures to boost growth in the short term. And then now there's going to be a big spending increase if this budget deal goes through. And those two things together will be the very rare occurrence of big fiscal stimulus at a time when unemployment is very low and the economy looks pretty healthy. So what that could mean for the economy is that growth will go much faster in the next year or two, and that wage growth will go up a lot in that time, and then inflation will start to rise. And just like the market fears, the Fed will step in and raise rates more often than we thought, and maybe more quickly than we thought.
And with a new director at the head of the Fed, how likely is that? He's been a protege of Janet Yellen.
Yeah, Jay Powell, I think we're trying, you know, with every new Fed chair, you kind of are guessing. But I think, you know, in general, what he has signaled, both in his confirmation testimony and in the way that he's behaved on the Fed until now, is that, you know, he endorses the path the Fed has been on, which has been a gradual but data-dependent increase in interest rates. And I think there may be pressure on him, political pressure, not to raise faster and potentially choke off growth. And so I think one of the real tests for his first year is going to be if there is a big inflation spike, will he raise faster than folks were expecting, even if he's got pressure not to?
What's your guess?
Well, my guess is that he's going to be – I mean, this is just a guess, but my guess would be that he's going to be as data-driven as Yellen and Ben Bernanke were, and that the Fed has been erring on the side of caution when it comes to inflation. They've been raising even though we haven't really seen much inflation. And so I think if we really started to see rapid inflation, we really could see Jay Powell's Fed raise rates faster than expected.
You know, President Trump has been taking credit for the strength in the stock market, but he has distanced himself in regard to any of the volatility currently occurring. Does he deserve credit? Does he deserve blame?
Presidents in general probably should not take too much credit or too much blame for what happens in the stock market. I do think that a couple of things that the president has done may be contributing to growth now or to expectations of growth in the future. Certainly, there has been a rise in business confidence and some investment increases based on the deregulation agenda that the president has pursued. And then the tax bill certainly seems like it is something that will boost growth to some degree, although there are big differing opinions on to what degree. But the president also inherited a very strong economy that was strengthening relative to the economy of the past several years. The last year or two of the Obama economy, we were finally starting to see very low unemployment and some wage growth for workers. And so he is taking credit for some things that were already in the works. And taking credit for stock gains that we do not typically associate with presidents.
So, Jim, speaking to the average American, how concerned should we be about this volatility going on in the market?
Well, I am not an investment advisor, and certainly would not want your listeners to go rearrange their portfolios based on what I'm about to say. But I think in general, the smart people I talk to say, for right now, the best thing to do is be calm. That yes, there's more volatility than we're used to, but this is historically not really out of the ordinary at all in terms of markets going up and down and having corrections. And so unless this starts to look like a much longer, more protracted slide, I think the people that I talk to are saying, just treat it like that. Treat it like a correction and kind of watch your way through it. I mean, I think that this is a fascinating time for all of us who are both in the economy and watching it. And I think that, you know, having covered the economy for the bulk of this recovery, it's an exciting time to be where we really are starting to see maybe more wage increases for the middle class and more workers finally seeing their pay go up. And my real question over the next year is going to be, can we maintain that as an economy? Can we really build on that and deliver wage gains that matter to hardworking people who didn't see those wage gains without overheating the economy? And the worry would be that that doesn't last very long, and then things come crashing back again to earth for workers. And the hope would be that you could sustain it like we did during the late 90s and really build some durable income gains. So, I think that is going to be the most interesting economic story over the next couple of years, and I hope that your listeners stay attuned to it.
Jim Tankersley, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Now a quick break.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
And we're back. Here's Julie Kohler, Senior Vice President for the Democracy Alliance, a progressive donor network. In this week's edition of The Nation, she looks at voting patterns of white women and explains why Democrats are holding out hope despite a history of their voting Republican. Julie, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's so nice to be here, Diane.
You know, at one point in this country, we used to talk about the women's vote, but somehow that's changed. What's happened?
Well, we've talked about the gender gap as a force in electoral politics for quite some time, but I actually think it's quite a misnomer, and it doesn't do us any good to continue to talk in those broad terms. There have been, in particular, Black feminist leaders that have rightfully identified the fact that the so-called gender gap in electoral politics is really a race gap. We have in this country a race gap of enormous proportions, about 40 to 50 points in most elections, and a gender gap of on average about 10 points. So when we see a gender difference or a gender split in how people vote and how men or women vote, it's largely driven by the fact that women of color vote overwhelmingly Democratic. They are the base of the Democratic Party, and they are the ones that are really driving progressive change in this country.
White women used to vote as a block. Do they do that anymore?
Well, I think there was a lot of surprise after 2016. We had, obviously, the first female presidential candidate. She was poised to shatter the ultimate glass ceiling. For many white progressives and white feminists, they were very energized by Hillary Clinton's candidacy. Moreover, they were really horrified by some of the misogynistic statements that we heard from candidate Donald Trump and the allegations of sexual misconduct that were alleged during the campaign. So there was a lot of surprise, I think, among white progressives and white feminists when the exit polls revealed that 53% of white women supported Donald Trump. What I think is important to understand is that the 2016 election was not an aberration. It actually reflected long-standing patterns of white women's voting behavior. If you go back to 1972, white women have, on average, supported the Republican candidate in almost every election. The only exceptions were actually in the 1990s, when women were about evenly split in their support for Bill Clinton and George H.W. Bush in 1992, and supported Bill Clinton by small margins in 1996. Mm. Otherwise, there's been a very entrenched and consistent pattern of white women, on average, voting Republican.
So how do you account for that? Are there differences in the goals that white women wish to achieve or the issues on which they're voting?
Yes, well, I think one of the other important things that we need to understand is that white women are not a monolithic voting bloc. And there are actually other dimensions of identity that are more strongly associated with white women's voting behavior than just their identity as white women. So in particular, if you look at the interplay between education level, between marriage, and between religion and religious preferences, that's what you see driving tremendous differences in how white women vote.
What do you mean in regard to marriage?
Well, yeah. So first of all, if you look at, you know, the split between college-educated and non-college-educated white women in 2016, there was about a 20% difference. College-educated women, white women, voted for Secretary Clinton at about 56%, whereas non-college-educated white women supported Secretary Clinton at about 36%. But if you look within those two categories, you also see major gaps based on marital status and based on religion. So there was about a 10% gap based on whether a woman was married or not. So married white women supported Secretary Clinton at lower rates than unmarried white women.
How do you account for that?
Well, I think there are several factors for this. There has actually been some research that shows that white women experience voting pressure from their more conservative white husbands. And so some of this may be the direct result of that, you know, interpersonal experience and pressure that they may be experiencing. But I think from a sociological perspective, there are also structural forces at work, and that all of us experience these larger social inequities in ways that affect what we perceive as rational choices. So, for example, the gender pay gap that is pervasive, it has the practical effect of privileging men, and particularly white men's, careers over women, and kind of yoking women's, married white women's, economic interest to their husbands. So for many married white women, they may have been voting based on what they perceived to be their family's economic interests, which were really their husband's economic interests.
But with more women in the workplace now, I mean, how do you account for that continued pattern?
Well, again, I think this is why kind of looking at these factors as interrelated makes a difference. So on going back to the differences between college-educated and non-college-educated women, college-educated women have more economic opportunity in this country. They may perceive their economic interests as less tied to their husbands because of their own economic opportunities. Similarly, religion is a really important variable to be looking at. And evangelical women, again, across both of these college-educated and non-college-educated categories, supported President Trump by about a 30% margin over non-evangelical women. So religious ideology and the values that drive people's voting behavior is another very important factor to look at.
Now, what about black women if they are married or unmarried?
We don't see those distinctions. We don't see similar distinctions. Black women overwhelmingly vote Democratic, 90-some percentage in most presidential elections and most elections across the board. So they are truly the base of the Democratic Party, and they drive progressive change in this country.
What happened in Alabama?
Again, we saw the same patterns repeated. So a majority of white women voters, about 63% according to exit polls, supported Republican Alabama Senate candidate Roy Moore, again, despite the allegations of sexual misconduct, in that case involving advances towards young girls as young as age 14. So that was, again, a shocking statistic to many of us, a shocking exit poll piece of data. However, I think, again, we also have to look at when you break down evangelical versus non-evangelical, when you break down on college education versus non-college education, you see some of the same patterns. And the difference between white women's overall support from President Trump in 2016 to Roy Moore in 2018 actually decreased by about 20%.
So in your work at the Democracy Alliance, are you following certain patterns, certain trends? And if so, what does that tell you about what's roiling beneath the surface?
Right. Well, I think there's been a lot of attention recently to women's anger as a political force. So not just in terms of voting behavior, but in terms of political activism, the energizing, the energized effect that women have had in terms of showing up and marching in the women's marches, the fact that women have really been the heart of what we call the progressive resistance, that women have been the ones driving political activism in defense of the Affordable Care Act when under assault by the Trump administration and Republican allies in Congress, that women have been very politically active locally, that we're seeing record numbers of women and a real multiracial array and diverse array of women who are running for office, have declared that they're running for office at every level, at the local level, at the state level, at the federal level. So 2018 could be a real wave in terms of women's political participation, but it's been difficult to reconcile. How do we make sense of the fact that we're seeing these overall trends in white women's voting behavior, and yet we're hearing these anecdotal reports that women have become, even some formerly apolitical women, have become incredibly politically energized and active? And I think it's too early to say definitively, but the Virginia election actually had some very interesting data that I think could be illustrative for future trends. Well, so Catalyst, which is a progressive data company, they came out with a recent report where they modeled and they tried to predict who was it that actually turned out in the recent Virginia gubernatorial election. And what they found was that there was both a swing and a surge among college-educated white women, that college-educated white women voted Democratic at percentages of about 8 to 9% over recent national averages, and that they turned out in greater numbers. So their vote share, the percentage of the overall electorate that was comprised of college-educated white women, was 1 to 2% above, again, recent national averages. Now, if that trend holds, we may be seeing that indeed certain subgroups of white women are reevaluating their political interests.
So one or two states, Virginia, Alabama, do not a trend or forecast make.
That's right. That's right. And so in the recent piece that I wrote for The Nation, I said, you know, we really need to think of white women as the frosting atop the cake of who is really the true progressive base, which is communities of color and particularly women of color. If we want to be mobilizing, if progressives want to be mobilizing those voters that are going to be supporting progressive candidates in the most, with the most enthusiasm and at the greatest rates, then we really need to be investing in communities of color. But we may be seeing the shift among some subgroups of white women, and we may be seeing the beginnings of a bit of a political realignment. So 2018, the midterm elections that will happen in November, will be very illustrative and we'll have lots to learn from what happens.
It seems to me that Hillary Clinton was accused of having taken for granted certain sectors of the population, and perhaps black women was one of those sectors.
Well, I think what it points to, I mean, black women supported Secretary Clinton in tremendous numbers. And so, you know, there was not much drop off in terms of support for Secretary Clinton from Barack Obama in prior elections. They remain an incredibly core base of the Democratic Party. But I think what we need to look at is that we need to think differently about communities of color and particularly women of color as not just constituencies to be mobilized in an election, but as the true drivers of progressive social change in this country. We need to be investing in organizing in these communities year-round, not just around an election cycle, but to make sure that the issues that are most directly confronting people's lives are the issues then that are, you know, that our elected officials are acting on. They should have a voice in the policy debates, not just kind of as a constituency to be mobilized in support of a candidate.
Take the wage gap, for example, and talk about how Democrats have approached that, how Republicans have approached that, and how women as a whole have reacted to that issue.
Well, we haven't seen a lot of policy action on this issue. So the wage gap has been entrenched for decades, and we have made just marginal progress on this. So I think this is, again, a reflection of the fact that those who are often the most reliable voters, their interests are not always the interests that set the policy agenda. And that really needs to shift. So I think, and something that I'm hopeful about, that if we start to see more diverse representation, if we see a very multiracial, diverse group of women entering elected offices at all levels, we'll begin to see similar shifts in policy priorities. And I think that is a really encouraging potential of this election.
Julie, we've talked about married women. Mm-hmm. What about single women mm-hmm. and how they approach political thinking, political issues, and the voting process?
Right, right. Well, again, we see greater support for Democratic candidates among unmarried women than married women. When we look at, you know, who experiences most directly some of the gendered barriers to full economic security and prosperity in our country, without a second income in the home, unmarried women experience that more directly. It makes sense that those issues may be more salient for them in driving their voting behavior than it might be for a married woman.
But they are coming out in great numbers. Is that correct?
We'll have to see. I mean, what we saw as kind of this surge and swing in the Virginia election, or what we are hypothesizing based on our early models, is that it was suburban college-educated women. And so these were both married and unmarried. It was not just a surge of unmarried women. So we'll have to see kind of what those rates are. But in terms of kind of who is a more reliable progressive voter, certainly unmarried white women tend to trend more progressive than do married white women.
We talked earlier about the allegations that were made against Donald Trump before and during the election process. I wonder if you believe that the widespread allegations of sexual misconduct among men in high places is going to drive even more Republican women to think differently about Republican candidates?
I think it's going to be very interesting to see. I think we are definitely at a pivotal moment right now, and I think there is greater awareness across almost every demographic group of sexual harassment and assault, how pervasive, how endemic these behaviors are. And I think there is a lot of anger about this. That said, I've also seen a lot of interesting leadership emerge. We've seen some leadership from evangelical Christian women leaders who have used their ministries to speak out on sexual harassment and assault. There's a hashtag campaign called Silence is Not Spiritual to bring greater awareness within their faith communities on how this type of behavior is not congruent with the religious values that they espouse. And so I think in terms of taking action on these issues, we may have a unique opportunity to develop some unlikely partnerships and to bring in some allies that may not agree with white feminists or any feminists, multiracial feminists, black feminists, on all issues, but really can see some points of commonality in terms of making some real change on some of these specific behaviors.
What about the so-called soccer moms?
Yeah, well, that's kind of the group that we were, you know, that we're interested in Virginia. So did this group of, you know, kind of middle class, college educated white soccer moms, did they start to turn out? We see some early data that might be the case, but we will really see in 2018 whether that is sustained in other states.
So you think this truly could be a turning point?
I think that we may be in a moment where, and again, I don't want to overstate this. I think it's really important to always say and to acknowledge that women of color are leading on progressive social change in this country. They will remain the progressive base. I'm not sure that I would even say that majorities of overall white women would vote Democratic in 2018 or beyond, but we may see greater support within certain subgroups. And I think that is an interesting realignment to take note of. And I think the other thing is we have to really look at how much of this is driven by outrage to President Trump versus how much is a really deeper political realignment that's taking place. And it's simply too early to tell on that.
In talking about outrage to Donald Trump, are you talking about policy? Or are you talking about behavior?
Well, I think that there's a bit of a mix. And so I think that Donald Trump has turned off certain segments of women voters, both by his policies and by his behavior, that either through the allegations of sexual misconduct, through some just kind of crassness of his tweeting and his demeanor, that there may be some Republican voters that may say, I'm not going to be in it with this guy. So I think we have to see whether this is kind of related to Trump as an individual or whether this is a more fundamental political realignment.
Julie, before we end, is there anything else you want to add?
Well, one of the interesting conversations I had when I was writing this piece for The Nation was with Bree Lascota, and she's the executive director of the Center for Religion and Civic Culture at the University of Southern California in Los Angeles. And I asked her specifically about kind of this other group of white women, married evangelical Christian women, women who are active in other conservative faith traditions. And what should, you know, are they organizable for progressive social change? And she really pushed back on the question and said the question itself is presumptuous because it assumes that these women are objects of study, that they are problems to be solved, and that it dismisses the fact that they may already be organized politically through other networks, through their religious and other conservative political networks. What she said, and I think is a really important point to take to heart, is that we also have to be thinking about the other mechanisms that drive meaningful social change, not just politics and policy, but the work that is involved in developing authentic relationships across dimensions of difference with people that we may disagree with quite strongly on many, many issues, but with whom we may also share some points of commonality. She pointed specifically to the evolution that we've seen among some evangelical Christians around acceptance of LGBTQ issues, and that a lot of this has been driven by what in sociological circles is called the Pal Al or the Aunt Susan effect, the fact that you have personal relationships with people that you love and care about, and that prompts you to think differently about political issues. And she was really emphasizing that a part of what we need to be looking at is how we're bridging those divides. How are we trying to reach out across these dimensions of difference and have authentic dialogues? We live in such an increasingly atomized society where so many of us exist within kind of our own ideological bubbles. We interact with people who think like us, and the fragmentation of the media has only added to this, so we watch and we absorb the messages that resonate with us politically. There's less and less of those spaces where we can really come together in authentic ways. And I think we have to give serious consideration to kind of what are those civic mechanisms that facilitate that? How are we all kind of in our own lives and our own relationships thinking about opportunities to really develop those relationships and interact in really meaningful ways, learn from people who are different from us, from people who have different values than us.
Even within families.
Yes.
That difficulty of bridging those gaps, I mean, we've heard about them around the Thanksgiving table, at Christmas, people not even willing to go home because they knew they were going to confront those differences. So if you can't even have that at home, how do you bridge that gap among or between people who barely know each other?
It's very hard. And the point that Bree made in my conversation with her was that this is not short-term tactical work. We are not going to, you know, come try to have a conversation with someone in the hopes of switching their vote necessarily for 2018. This is really about authentic relationship building. She's described it as long-term and transcendent, not short-term and tactical.
Does she offer advice on how to begin?
There are resources actually available, and I'd be happy to share some of those with you to post to the website if that would be helpful.
Good.
On how we do have these very difficult conversations, but it really has to be in the context of being in relationship with someone and having some point of commonality, some point of affinity or love for someone that we can venture into these challenging territories.
Julie Kohler, you've been so helpful. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Diane.
And that's all for this week. I'd love to hear what's on your mind. Connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. Send us an email. drpodcast@wamu.org or leave us a voicemail. The number is 202-854-8851 and go to our website, dianereen.org. Our theme music was composed by Cliff Harden, comes to us courtesy of the Capitol Soundtrack Project here at WAMU. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Our engineer is Douglas Bell. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Reed.